But first, I want to dedicate this class to my friend Ari Ben-Sarat-Yemenu, who's in the hospital, and everything should go in the right direction, which is probably going to be crossing over, but it should go easily for him. Okay, take my deep breath. Okay. Okay, today we're going to look at the Greeks, Hellenism, and Hanukkah. So I left you off with a cliffhanger last week of the kingdom divided and the Jews right in the middle. So we have the southern kingdom, the Ptolemaic kingdom, which is based in Egypt and Alexandria is the capital, and the northern kingdom, the Seleucid kingdom, which is based in Damascus, and that's the capital, but it's the northern kingdom, Syria, and beyond. That's actually a much bigger kingdom than the southern kingdom. But the Jews at this point are kind of aligning themselves or find favor with the southern kingdom, which is the Egyptian kingdom. It's interesting that the Jews have an affinity for Egypt. There's sort of like a morbid love, whatever it is, something with the Jews in Egypt since we were slaves there. And even though we left and even though we were happy to leave, there's still this draw and this pull. And in a way, it's sort of like, not quite really at all, but I just see that there is this morbid curiosity about Christianity also. You know, that Jews are curious about it. And Rabbi Tuvia Singer has this whole tape series which is really based on the Jews' curiosity for Christianity. Because really, even though he does anti-missionary work and has really worked on helping Jews who are Christian or Hebrew Christians come back to their Judaism, his whole tape series called Outreach Judaism, available online now for free downloads, is really teaching Judaism through the Jews' curiosity about Christianity. So it's interesting to see how he does that. Because Jews tend to be curious. But anyway, the Jews are fascinated with Egypt. They're fascinated with Greece at this time, too. We talked about assimilation last time and how the Jews are fascinated with cultures that they see as sophisticated, which the Greek culture was. And so they're interested in the Ptolemaic rulership in the south. Initially, it wasn't such a friendly rulership. Initially, Ptolemy I, who ruled from the death of Alexander the Great until 285 BCE. He ruled harshly and exiled many of the Jews, as was common at the time, conquer territory, exile the inhabitants of the territory to destabilize the inhabitants so they wouldn't rebel, take them and put them in another land so nobody's fighting for their homeland. So he did that. He took a lot of the Jews. He brought them down to Egypt. He made some of them slaves, and he put some of them into his armies, and his army was pretty strong and pretty broad, so Jews were in outposts all over the kingdom. They were able to eventually buy their freedom and, by kingly decree, get their freedom from Ptolemy II, who came to leadership in 285 to 246 BCE. He was a leader of peace and culture, and he created libraries and schools, and so the Jews really liked that. Being the intellectual people that we are, and with such high rates of literacy, there was that, this is where the synergy kind of started to coalesce even more. Now, as much as the Jews were interested in the Greeks were also very interested in the Jews. And we had a different kind of culture than they had experienced anywhere. I mean, the dominant practice of the time was conquer the territory and then embrace the religion of the place and incorporate it. But this is the only place where the religion couldn't easily be embraced because it was so different than anything else because Judaism is exclusive. So, and that was not the way of the world at the time. Everybody else kind of, their religions could work with. It's, you could have your gods, I'll have my gods, we could all have our gods, it's fine, the gods can work together. But the Jews don't believe in that. The Jews believe one God in charge of everything, no room for other gods. So that didn't work with incorporate, embrace, and live and let live kind of philosophy. So there were some question marks about how you live and let live, and should you live and let live, and how do you conquer, and particularly because, and this is where the United States differs from all of this long history, religion and state are mixed. So the part of the conquering of the people is incorporating your ideas into their heads and your religious ideas too, which help you have a hold on them. So the church was certainly good at that, creating the whole, meek will inherit the earth philosophy, and the rich won't get into heaven, right? It's easier for a camel to pass through an eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into heaven. That's from the New Testament. So those philosophies together worked out great for the church, because if you had money, you better not have money, so give it to the church. They'll take care of it so you can be poor so you can get to heaven. So like those kinds of philosophies were developed in the church and in other religions too to keep the masses in line. Judaism was different than that and couldn't be influenced by philosophy, so couldn't easily be incorporated. It was made for all kinds of problems. In addition, the Greeks were very curious about this Jewish God who is different than all other gods. A kind and compassionate and loving God who runs everything, created everything, and still has a hand in history was a completely foreign concept to them. And it was fascinating. So they were interested in, and Ptolemy II was very interested in this book that the Jews had. So he's busy creating libraries and schools, and he wants to incorporate the great literature of the world into his libraries, into the greatest library that there was at the time in Alexandria. So he wants all the books of the world. So the Book of the Jews is a big book, and he wants it. It's a closed book, basically. It's written only in Hebrew, and he wants a translation of it. So he decides he's going to get this book for his library. So it's interesting because, as I said, there's kind of a, in a way, a symbiosis or some kind of relationship between the two. The Greek culture and the Greek language was recognized by the rabbis as the most beautiful language. And apparently, I learned in preparing for this class, I didn't realize this, that the only other language a kosher Torah scroll can be written in is Greek. Go no, that's, yeah. Right. It can't be kosher written in any other language. And parenthetically, that's one reason why the Ethiopian Jews had to convert, is because their Torah scrolls were written in Amharic. So they had lost the tradition. And we Jews don't lose the tradition. So that's why we wondered about their lineage. Had they, if they lost the tradition of their Torah scroll, what other traditions did they lose? And so they required conversion. But our Torah scrolls have always been in Hebrew. I don't think I never saw it, so maybe it was just theoretical. I never heard of a Torah scroll in Greek. But apparently in the Talmud it says that that is the other language. So it is considered, and the Talmud says it's the most beautiful language. So whatever that means. I mean, if you saw my big fat Greek wedding, I guess, you know, then of course you know Greek is beautiful. But anyway, so the Jews are interested in Greek culture and Greek language, and the doors opened to Greek culture and Greek language when they promise Alexander the Great that they're going to name all their sons the next year after him, Alexander, bringing a Greek name and actually opening the door to Greek names into the Jewish people. So Greek names opens the door to some Greek culture, to some language, to some thought, and language opens the door to culture. So when Ptolemy says, I'm going to have the Torah in my library, and the way I'm going to do it is have 70 rabbis translate it for me. I'm going to put them all in separate rooms, have them all translate, and then compare their translations. So this is called the translation of the 70, the Targum Shivim, or the Septuagint. So this is an important translation and a miraculous translation. So all 70 rabbis go into their separate rooms. Now, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that can be translated in strange ways and has now been used, let's say, against the Jews. Oh, you say you're monotheistic? What does it mean when God says, let us make man? What's that plural? That plural must be referring to the Trinity, right? So some Christians say that. But it does say, let us make man. So those rabbis who translated the Septuagint knew to not translate it that way. They all had specific divine inspirations to translate certain things in allegorical ways to make it clear what it was meant. So they didn't translate that in the plural, for instance. So just, I'll make man, or however they translated it. But they translated certain problematic passages in ways that would be more understandable, according to the understandings of the rabbis. It turned out that they all translated it that way. So that was the miracle. Excuse me, is that they all agreed. Beryl Wine, on one of his tapes that I listened to once, said the way that Jews agree, you know, there's two Jews and three opinions, said it would have been a greater miracle if he would have put all 70 in one room and they came out with the translation that they agreed on. So anyway, they did come up with a translation, and that really opened the door wider for Greek culture to come into the Jews and for Jews to connect with Greek culture. apparently only in societies where the Jews were interested in that culture and thought that there was something worthwhile in the culture, did they write books in that language. So we don't find holy books written in Polish or Russian, but we do find them written in Arabic, and we do find them written in English. And most of them were written in Hebrew or Mishnaic Hebrew, but certainly in Arabic and in Greek and in English. So in cultures, and I don't know, you know, enough of the breadth, and in German, Rav Hirsch wrote in German, but we don't have really, and we have books in Yiddish, but we don't have Russian or Polish or even Persian. Remember I told you last week that the Persians were considered boors too. We don't have books written in languages of places where we looked down upon their cultures, only in places where we felt their cultures were peers or we looked up to the culture. So here we have this book that's now our book is in Greek. So now our sealed book becomes an open book, and this our sealed book becomes the oral law, which is still pretty sealed. And that was one, it was a huge controversy, should Art Scroll translate it or not? Because the Art Scroll translation that we have now is a very careful translation with a lot of explanation. And there was really controversy. Should we open it that much that you could really access it in English almost without a teacher, but you still can't? They realize it's still, even though it's really translated and really explained and carefully footnoted, and I don't know if you've seen the translation, but it has one page of the classic Gemara text and the other page in English, and there's a gray bar on the classic page that just shows which portion of the page is being translated on the English page. And it might have that same Gemara text 5 pages in a row with that bar moving down and all the translation in the English, and then flip it and put the other text on the other side so that you still have the feeling of that Gemara page on the correct side of the page, because, you know, it's set up in a certain typeset that's always the same. Since the Vilna edition, it's always the same. As a matter of fact, scholars of the Gemara who are true scholars can pass the ultimate test, the pin test. So the pin test is if you take a pin and poke it through one letter and it goes through all those pages, imagining that it can go through all those pages, that a real scholar could tell you what letter it hits on every page because he knows what that page looks like. It's not changed. So even though the Talmud was edited, not edited, what's the word, when things were taken out?
Abridged.
Not revised, not abridged, when things were taken out, but censored. Even though it was censored by Christian censors and things, like for instance, passages about Jesus and some other things were taken out by Christian censors, and they were set on the side, that happened before the Vilna edition was typeset. Now that it's typeset, and now that we don't have that censorship, and now that we could put it back in, we don't, because now we have the way the page looks, and it stays the way it looks, so that there can be that conversation across the ages about where you find it on what page and what letters are next to what, and all that discussion can happen, so the points of reference are always the same, and those parts that were censored out were added in at the end, so they have addendums in the back of the volume of where they should go, but the Vilna page is the same.
Question. Now the Septuagint, was that the book that carried through most of the ages until they made the changes?
No, that the Septuagint is the 5 books of Moses. This is just the Talmud. Oh, so we're end parentheses back to Septuagint. Okay. So back to the Septuagint. This is a very important concept to know. There's so much information in this. In this whole series, I'm trying to think. Okay, what are the main points that I want to make? Because like history, so you hear dates and stuff, but so here is a main point that's important to remember. The Septuagint, the Targum Shivim, it's the same thing, the translation of the 70. This translation into Greek was a major opening for cross-cultural conversation, but B, the text that was used for the King James Version. So the translation from the Hebrew into the Greek was then translated into Latin and was then translated into English. So you should know that most of the Christian translations are thrice translated. And so this has led to a lot of problems. This has led to entire doctrinal question marks. I mean, Catholicism is holding a lot of baggage because of this process of translation. So I'll give you one for instance. In Isaiah, not even the 5 books, because they translated the 24 books, So that includes the prophets and the writings. In the book of Isaiah, the whole virgin birth problem crops up, or the whole virgin birth problem comes from one sentence in Isaiah. So it was a classic legend at the time that virgin birth was a possibility, and it led greater import to a leader to claim that he was born of a virgin. Julius Caesar claimed that he was born of a virgin. So it works out very nicely for Jesus to be born of a virgin, gives him greater import. Where do they get the textual proof that he was born of a virgin? Comes from a passage in Isaiah where the word that's used for a young girl is Alma, young girl. We have another word for virgin. A young girl may be a virgin, but she may not. But there's a technical term for virgin, which is betula or basula, right? So, but we have those two words. So Alma doesn't mean virgin. It means young girl. But in Greek, there is one word for both. So it, virgin and young girl is the same word. So now you take the word Alma, you translate it into Greek. And now you take that Greek word and you translate it into Latin. So now they have to decide, how are they going to translate that out of meaning both into meaning which one? Virgin. Right? So now you have the entire doctrine of virgin birth and of Mother Mary and everything that she represents in Catholicism, all based on a mistranslation a few times from the Septuagint. So the Ramban, which is different than the Rambam, Nachmanides, and the way you can tell the difference is by where the accent is, Rambam, accent in the beginning, Ramban, accent in the end. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, lists all kinds of translation problems and the doctrinal difference that it made in Christianity and where they come from, the mistranslations that they come from. So it's fascinating to see. So that's an important concept to get here, is that that translation is the translation from which most of the English translations come from today. So it's important when we are reading, anyway, to pick up an R.E.A. Kaplan translation. He went straight from the Hebrew into the English. You know, sometimes in Art Scroll worked with a few different translations, but my understanding is that they used some of King James also. So go for the, if you want to read it in a good translation, read the R.E.A. Kaplan translation straight from the Hebrew into the English. Or learn Hebrew. That's even better because it really does make a difference. I mean, the words really make a difference in that language. Okay, so now we have that translation, and so that's opened up the door even more. So we have the Jews now sitting in between, still these two kingdoms, where they're kind of being fought over, tried to be won in the different ways that you can try to win people. Bless you. So militarily, and then also ideologically, and the pulls in both directions with both different methodologies. Shall we be nice to you? Shall we be harsh with you? Shall we be nice to you? Shall we be harsh with you? And working both ways. But meanwhile, the Jews are in the middle of two great kingdoms and are profiting considerably from all the trade that's passing through. So they are making tons of money, and an upper class arises. And that upper class, you know, it seems sometimes when Jews get money that they sometimes stray from Torah values. And in this case, that happened. And so the upper class was very interested in the southern kingdom's Hellenistic philosophies. And so they became Hellenized. Now, the term Hellenized, Hellenization, I'm sure you know, comes from Queen Helena, a Greek queen. But Hellenization, or the Hellenists, in this case, refer to the Jews who became Greek-ized. In Hebrew, we call that Misyavnim or Mityavnim. Yavan is Greece in Hebrew. So Lehit Yavain would be to become Greek. So we have a few different Lehit, whatever it is, to become somethings. Lehit Natser, to become Christian. Lehit Yavain, to become Greek. Lehit Gayer, it's not Lehit Yahed, but Lehit Gayer is to become Jewish, right, to convert. But anyway, the Mityavnim, or the Misyavnim, depending on how you pronounce that letter, were the Hellenists. And they were basically that upper class, initially, philosophically, an upper class. Okay, so meanwhile, we have that growing, but let's backpedal just a second. So at the death of Shimon HaTzadik, right, so the last member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, he dies, he's the Kohen Gadol, and now the question is, who takes his place, right? So there's, I can't remember if it's his two sons or two people who are vying for the position, two brothers. Usually it goes to the older one. In this case, it went to the younger one. Skip the story of the younger one because it doesn't really matter at this point. What happened is what happened to the older one, the one who got dissed. So he did what many people do when they, especially Jews, when they don't get what they want. he took off and started his own thing. So he went to Alexandria. He didn't just start a shul there. He built a Beis HaMikdash. He built a whole holy temple, complete with Kohanim that he imported from Israel, sacrifices, spices, the whole works. It was a huge thing. And Josephus writes that it was more beautiful than the temple in Jerusalem.
Where was this?
This temple in Alexandria. Alexandria. Now, it was completely treif because you can only have the holy temple in Jerusalem. And yet, the Alexandrians, maybe similar to New Yorkers today, sort of felt that they're the center of the whole world. And really, Jerusalem's a backwater compared to them, the real Jews, who live in Alexandria, the real cultured ones. So they were they loved their temple, they loved their high priest, they loved the attraction that it was and the beauty of the building. And remember, we talked about how the Greeks really experimented with architecture and mathematics to create amazing architecture, so this was an amazing building. And it was a tourist attraction. And the Greeks and the Jews in Alexandria were, it was a Jewish center, a very huge community there. And spread out, because remember I said with Ptolemy I, he spread out Jews around his empire in positions in the army, so that spread the community out and made strongholds all around, but the center was Alexandria. And had a nice, then the Jews prospered there very nicely. In fact, not only did they have the temple, but they built one of the biggest synagogues in the world. So big that apparently it had 8,000 to 10,000 seats, which before a public address system, electric systems, you couldn't really get your voice that far to cover that many people. So in order to say amen, the place was so big that they had to wave flags to show you where they were in the services so people would know to say amen. It was huge. So, and this is not stories. This is documented history here. So it was a huge synagogue.
Was this during Ptolemy II?
Yes. I think so. Yeah. Yes.
So why would it be considered treif?
You can't have the holy temple outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the holy city with that mountain, which is where the temple is supposed to be. That is the space in which the energy of God is concentrated in a way, and where that's where our holiest, we could have synagogues anywhere, but not a temple with sacrifices and Kohanic ritual can only be in that spot.
Because
that's the spot God said, and that's the only spot there is. Which is why today, even though we have the state of Israel with the Jewish government and all kinds of schools and all kinds of rabbis and all kinds of knowledge, we don't have a temple today, because the spot is right under that dome. Right? And so that Dome of the Rock has to go first. We're not going to take it away, but God will at the right time. But we can't have a temple until it's on that spot. It has to be there. So having one in Alexandria was just about the ego of a guy and then the ego of his followers to have, you know, what they wanted to do in another place.
Did they do the sacrifices?
They did the sacrifices. They did everything. They didn't have the miracles. There were miracles that were manifest in the temple, so obviously they didn't have that. But they did do the whole service with the spices and the sacrifices and the blood sprinkling and the whole nine yards. They had the whole thing. Okay. Although, so that flourished for 300 years. The Jewish center in Alexandria flourished for 300 years, was a huge center of Jewry, until the city of Alexandria was sacked by pirates, and basically the whole Jewish community was wiped out. I mean, either ran away or was killed, and it never recovered. It never became a Jewish center again, till this day. So there are still Jews who live in Egypt, but not too many. And when the Rambam lived there later on, actually Jews are not supposed to live in Egypt. The Rambam lived there later on in the 1200s, and it's a whole other piece of history. I don't know if we'll get to that, if we get to that together, but he used to sign his letters, signed by Moses ben Maimon, the transgressor of three sins, one of which was living in the land of Egypt. So he signed every letter that way. Ha'over al shlosha lavim, the one who transgresses on three sins, because he lived where he shouldn't be living. And he just wanted to keep it clear in his mind and others' minds, he's a transgressor, lives where he shouldn't. Okay, back to the Jews' position then in the middle. So we have this going on in Alexandria, we have back and forth, and now finally there is the battle of, so I wrote in here, that's the way it was spelled, and I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Panias, but in Hebrew today we call it the Banias, which is really from the Arabic pronunciation of Panias. So if you've ever been to there's a spring in Israel in the north called the Banias, right? It's a waterfall and it's very pretty. That area was fought over. When that area, the battle of that area switched the fate of the Jews of the place. That's what, right, at that time, the Antiochus was the king in the northern kingdom, the Seleucid king. And with the battle of the Banias, he became in control of the whole land of Israel. So still, the Jews are pro-Greek in general. But Antiochus wasn't so thrilled with the whole you're not buying into the Hellenistic philosophy en masse kind of concept, because now it's been 100 years or so and he can really see that the Jews are not completely giving up Judaism, not as a whole. You have some people who are. And in fact, I think I mentioned before that they had many of the Hellenistic Jews would actually reverse their circumcisions. Did I mention that? That, yeah, because they did so much stuff naked that the men really wanted to show that they're part of the group. And they went through very painful surgery without anesthesia to make themselves look like the rest of their Greeks. Because it was important to them to fit in. So, and circumcision was considered a blight. Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, it's bad enough watching men around a circumcision because they all stand there with their legs crossed like... You know, but to think of reversing it is way worse, way worse. And yet they did it. So that just shows how interested they were in fitting in because, yeah, they were willing to do that. So meanwhile, Antiochus comes and he installs his own high priest. And he really works on establishing kind of a control religiously, putting a puppet into the office of high priest. Now, the trick is, though, that because the temple was in a holy place and did have some miracles going on, the high priest, one of his jobs was to go into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur with the right kind of rituals and everything he had to do. If he wasn't doing it right, even if he didn't have the right intent, he would die in there. So before, and he was the only one who could go in there. So what they would do before he went in there was tie a rope around him in case he died, so they could pull him out, because nobody else could go in there and even retrieve him. So year after year, they bit the dust. One Kohen Gadol after another, and yet the position was so high that other people volunteered for the job, and they were placed in as puppets, and they would get their year of service, but which is pretty amazing to me, like that people could think that they could trick God, but somehow they did, and they took the job. But he did establish this concept of a puppet religious leader, to try to bring the Jews in line that way. It didn't work so well. But it turns out he had other allies, and the other allies were the Jews, sometimes were our own worst enemy, were the Jews who understood Judaism, who had left Judaism. And so they were able to say, Antiochus, you want to know really how to get to the Jews? There are a few core principles that if you take care of these, the Jews won't be able to function. Start off with Bris Milah. Just say no circumcision. You know, the idea that their body is perfect, born perfect, that Greek idea, and if it's not, of course, infanticide, but that you have a perfect body and that you shouldn't be touching it, we need to impose that on the Jews. The Jews, one reason why we circumcise is to say, you're born imperfect. You're born in need of completion. And that's your job in the world, is to complete yourself. You come into the world kind of a blob, and you have to form yourself into a mensch. Female or male, but males, even more, women are considered born a little closer to the ideal. Males a little further from the ideal, and so males have to start with circumcision. So that's the physical act that says, I will shape this body, this person, into what it needs to be, and I'll start with this act. So first, get rid of that, so that people know that they are what they are, and they don't have free will. It's not that they are who they shape themselves into. They are what they are. So Bris Milah, get rid of that. And then get rid of Shabbat, marking time and recognizing that God is the creator of everything and that you can withdraw from the world and God will continue to run it. You have to can that idea, because basically we want them to understand that humans run the world. And without human intervention, how is it going to work? God's not in charge. Humans are in charge. We do believe in God or gods, but God's made it and left it, and it's up to humans to run it. For us, keeping Shabbat says God made it, God runs it, and one day a week we step back and say, God, you're totally in charge. I withdraw my influence from the world. You run it, and I recognize you're in charge of everything. So take that away from the Jews. So they shouldn't be in charge. They shouldn't think that God's in charge, that human beings are in charge. And then you have to take away the Jewish calendar, because the Jewish calendar counts by months. And months mean renewal. The Jewish concept is renewal. Now, you wouldn't know this if you weren't Jewish. So it took a Jew to explain this, why getting rid of the calendar is so important. But we Jews count time differently than the non-Jews do. The non-Jews count it by the sun, which is a year cycle, a year of repetition, shana. If you think of the word shana, year, is the same word as we say in the Shema, vishinantam levanecha vidibartabam, right? That's the same root, vishinantam. You should repeat these words to your children. So the word for year and the word for repeat is the same. So it's a cycle of repeat, repeat, repeat. So the non-Jews, particularly the Egyptians, count by the sun. We Jews count by the months. We count by the chodesh. The root is chadash, renewal, innovation. We're all about making new starts all the time, always fresh, always changing, always thinking, always reassessing, always becoming something new. We aren't born as we're born and that's how we are. We're in total control and we get to be whoever we choose to be. And that is the concept of how we count time completely differently. In addition to the fact that we have holidays that are based on the way we count the time. We're in charge of placing those holidays by how we sanctify the new moons. It's a whole different calendar discussion, but the Jews participate in setting the dates of, so we know that, for instance, Passover is on the night of the 14th, 15th of Nisan. But we are the ones who set when the first of the month is, which will depend on that. So the 15th is dependent on the first, and the first could be this day or that day, depending on how the Jews sanctify it. So we interact with that, and we set those days. So without our participation in that calendar, our holidays are messed up, our concept of renewal is messed up, and our whole Jewish life is messed up. So he said, get rid of the calendar. And the last one was learning Torah, the intellectual pursuit of the Jews. If you let them learn Torah, so they're going to continue to renew themselves with all that narishkeit that's written in that book about how they should be connected to God and everything. Now, to can the Torah and get them into Greek philosophy, send them to the gymnasiums, and we'll be able to assimilate them and everything will work out great. So he had those, excuse me, those four main decrees. Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh, Brit Milah, learning Torah. Didn't work out so well. The Jews weren't really interested in giving it all up, so he really started a reign of terror. Let me see if I have my... Let's see if I have a Josephus. Yeah. So this is actually from the Book of Maccabees, this quote that I'll read you, which is not on your sheet. Not long after this, the king sent an Athenian senator to compel the Jews to forsake the laws of their fathers and cease to live by the laws of God, and also to pollute the temple in Jerusalem and call it the temple of Olympian Zeus. So they definitely understood what they were happening. Now, here's another important point. Besides all the details here, major point is there had never been religious persecution before. This was the first, because in all other societies, all religions were fine. It's just the Jews who are getting in the way, as usual, with their philosophies that make it difficult to rule them, because they have this whole thing about how they're ruled by the King of Kings, a king that's in charge of the king who says he's in charge of you. So it makes it very difficult to rule this unruly people. So religious persecution, it's a first, and that leads to the first religious war. Because no pagan was going to die for his God. So also, how strange are we that we're willing to die for these principles? We're willing to say, kill me before I eat a piece of pig in front of you, or before I bow down to your idol, or before I do whatever you are asking me to do to serve your idol. I'll die before I do that. Nobody else was willing to say that. In the world at the time, people didn't die for religious values. Only we did. So these were new things to encounter, a people who was that stubborn, which, as you know, we are that stubborn. So now we have how we know some of the things that happened in this next story that I'm going to tell you that happened in Modi'in is from the Book of Maccabees. Now, the Book of Maccabees, there's two of them, Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. And the 1 and 2 are not like Samuel 1 and 2, Kings 1 and 2, where one's a continuation of the other. They're two different versions written by different people at that time. They're not canonized. They're part of the Apocrypha because, if you remember, we talked about the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, canonized the 24 books of the Bible. And they decided what should be in and what should be out based on what was written with divine inspiration and what wasn't. So now that the era of prophets is over with the building of the Second Temple, and this is during Second Temple times. Another book that's written can't be written with divine inspiration because prophecy is done. So it can be written as a historic account, and we do hold that these are historically accurate accounts, but they're not considered divine, so they're not part of the canon. But there are two different accounts, and those are the Book of Maccabees. Okay, so in the Book of Maccabees is a story that happened in Modi'in. Modi'in is a small town outside of Jerusalem, still exists today, or a new town exists in that space today, Modi'in. So in Modi'in, that's where Mattathiah lived with Mattathias with his five sons, primary one being Judah, the Maccabee, right? So this is the Maccabee family. Now they're called Maccabee. It's really appellation, Maccabee being hammer, and they were very strong, and so they're called that. How are they very strong, though? They're high priests. They're of a priestly family, so really they're physically weak because their job is to teach Torah. So we all know, if you look at, you know, the scholars in any yeshiva, except for those who have a basketball court, which is the yeshiva sport, because it doesn't take much space. they're basically pale and weak. You know, they're just a bunch of, they sit in yeshiva all day long. So how strong could they really be? Maybe not so much today. We have a little more physical, but certainly traditionally our scholars were considered physically weak. And we also have a principle that learning Torah weakens one physically, because there is a zero-sum game between physical and spiritual, and the more you invest in the spiritual, the less you can invest in the physical, and so a scholar will be weaker. Anyway, so you have these Maccabees who are strong spiritually, and they're living in Modi'in, and the decrees have been sent out by Antiochus, and one of them is there's got to be a statue of Zeus in every town, every hamlet, and the soldiers fan out. So the little contingent of Greek soldiers comes with their statue of Zeus to set up the altar to Zeus in the town of Modi'in. And they call the Jews to the square, they set up the statue, they set up the altar, and they say, okay, here's a pig. We want you guys to sacrifice this pig to Zeus. And the Jews, of course, are mortified and say, absolutely not. But one Hellenized Jew steps forward and says, I'll do it. So rather than that huge desecration of God's name happening, Mattathiah steps up behind him and stabs him and kills him. Well, you can't just kill him, which he needed to be killed because he's about to transgress in public like this. But now you have everybody's in danger now. All the Jews are there, so the Greek guards have to be killed too because they saw it. So he kills the Greek guards, right? Now, okay, no problem. Those four or five Greek guards are now dead, except for when they don't come home, somebody's going to figure out that they're dead. And so now the whole town's in jeopardy. So everybody leaves for the hills and the caves, which are nearby. And that's how the war breaks out, really, the war between the Maccabees and the Greeks. There's additional stories to that because there really wasn't, it's interesting to hear, that is one of the stories. An undercurrent that's important to know about the Hanukkah story is that women play a very important role. So in another town is Hannah with her seven sons. And when the Greek guards come there and say, bow down to the idol, and she has her seven sons, the first one says, no, I won't bow down, and they kill him. And so they bring up the second one. He says, no, I won't bow down, and they kill him. All the way down to the baby, the toddler, who the king's thinking, like, if I don't get him to bow down, you know, then it's really, then I lose, right? Because then the whole family stood up against me. So he doesn't say bow down. He takes off his ring and he throws it in front of the idol and says, go pick that up for me. So that he'll have to bow down in front. And the toddler says, no, I won't. And he dies, and then they kill her too, the mother. So, but she's considered a heroine because she raises the family who understands with such clarity, down to the toddler, that they're not doing this. They're going to die before they're going to do this. So that's the story of Hannah. And then we have a story of Yehudit also, but I'll just tell you another story, which may be apocryphal and may not, but one of the decrees was no circumcision. And so the mothers said, well, we're for sure circumcising our children because there's no question that our whole quest is to teach them Torah and raise them to shape themselves. So we're not giving that up. So if you men are too chicken to circumcise, we're going to circumcise. And so some of them did it in public display, so this is where it might be apocryphal. On top of the walls of Jerusalem, they would circumcise their sons and then jump off to make a public display of their death. Because some people were, men who circumcised their sons, were killed with their sons around their neck. And so they knew that they would be killed anyway, but rather than be killed by the guards, just make the display that we are willing to die for this mitzvah. So again, that story may be apocryphal, it may be true, but that the what is true is that women pushed the war into being, especially because one of the decrees that's not listed here but was very important, I forgot how you say it in Latin, but was the decree of the governor gets first rights with the bride. So the brides had to go to the governor first, the Greek governor first, before her husband. Terrible decree. You have virgin brides, scary enough as a virgin, and you're newly married, and who wants the governor to have his turn at you first before your husband? So they did all kinds of things, trying to move wedding dates and have secret weddings and not let people know that there were weddings and all kinds of things like that, but not everybody could avoid the decree. So when it became the turn of, I forgot her name, Maccabee's sister, she went in front of the town square and disrobed in public. And her brother said, "What are you doing? We're a religious Kohen family. How could you disgrace your family like that by disrobing in public? Where's your sense of modesty?" She said, "Where's my sense of modesty? Where's your sense of propriety? If you think this is a desecration, what is it when the Roman governor is going to have me as a virgin bride? That's a real desecration, and I don't see you fighting that. So let's go, guys. Let's start the war." So she's the one, really, who sparked the thing. So it's a very strong story of women. So women had an extra redemption, which is why when the Hanukkah candles burn, during the time of the actual burning of the candles, it is considered an extra time of sanctity for women. So even though we're often making latkes during that time, we're not really supposed to be working during that time. That's our special female holiday during the time when the candles are burning, because we had an extra redemption over the men, because we had that extra decree on us that the men didn't have, but we had that extra redemption. Okay, so anyway, you have the story of the of Modi'in and the different stories of sparking of the war. The Maccabees, so they're called the Maccabees because of Hammer, but as Jews do, we switched it into a Hebrew word and broke up the letters, so not just Hammer, but made it into an acronym, Mi Kamocha Be'elim Hashem, who is like you in heaven's God. And that adds up, if you take the first letters of each of those words, that adds up to Maccabee. So that's the battle cry of the Jews, that God is first and we are doing God's work. Okay, quick. Okay, so I said religious war. It was never known before. We usually embraced and that people would die, so that's what religious war here means. And now into internal and external. So this was a war not just against the Greeks, but against the Jews. So it was really a three-way war, faithful Jews, Hellenized Jews, Greeks. So faithful Jews are fighting both their brethren and the Greeks. So really the war was Torah and Greek philosophy. So it was a war of ideas fought by people, but it was really a war of ideas. So that's basically what was happening, was this war of ideas. And Hanukkah is, just jumping down just a drop, Hanukkah's two major victories. There's the military victory, but then the spiritual victory that we Jews get to do what we need to do in our land. So it's not a holiday of religious freedom. And it's not a festival of lights either at all. Actually, the miracle of the lights was a tiny little miracle. And it's not even recorded in the book of the Maccabees, which is the whole historic thing of it. It's just mentioned in the Talmud. The real miracle is the military victory, that this little scrappy bunch of Jews who were untrained, who dwelled in caves, were able to fight the well-trained professional Greek army and win. That's the real victory. It took a long time for that victory. This was not a several-week thing. This was a multi-year process. So it was about 3 years until we get the candle miracle, but it was a 25-year war, actually. So it was not an ultimate victory. The reason why we light candles, a few reasons why we light lights, is one, light represents wisdom. Oil represents wisdom in Jewish thought. And it's interesting to see that we do have a board here, but nothing to write with. Okay, so let me see if I could do this thing. If you can see this at all. Okay, so this is HaShemen, the letters for the oil. Oil represents wisdom in Judaism, and so that's one reason why we anoint with oil. When we anoint a king, he should have the wisdom to rule properly in the oil of anointing. But the concept of oil and fire always burns upwards. Even if you turn a candle upside down, it always is striving to go up. And so somebody with wisdom is always striving to go up, even if you'll turn them, striving to go up. So oil represents the wisdom that's striving to go upwards. So, but if you rearrange these letters, you get, how many days is Hanukkah? How long is it?
8 days.
8 days. So you get, let's see. Sorry if it's hard to see, but you get 8. It's the same letters. So you get 8 out of Hashemen, the oil, you get 8. Now 8 is the day, 8 is the number of supernatural. Natural, 7 days in the week, 7 colors in the rainbow, 7 notes in the scale, in the Western scale anyway. But 7 is the number of Sheva, Soveya, whole and complete. And 8 is considered one above that. So 8 is the realm, even if you think about the letter 8, so you have infinite, right, but number 8. But 8 is the realm of the soul, above and beyond nature. So we circumcise on the 8th day, because the whole point of circumcision is to take the soul and elevate it through the means of the body. So if you rearrange the letters again, on top, look on top for whoever can read, you get neshama. Neshama is 8, is soul, right? So it comes from that. So it's all tied in. So you have this battle that's really over the souls of the Jewish people, where our eyes, our wisdom was darkened for the, and the Greek wisdom supplanted it. But what happened in the end was, even though they melted down our golden menorah, there was a makeshift menorah placed back in the temple when they rededicated the temple to God, took it away from Zeus and rededicated it to God, and wanted to relight the menorah. So the oil, and it's a whole different discussion, the why, the miracle, etc., but that was a pretty small miracle compared to the military victory. But the lasting thing to remember is not that we won the war, but we won the ideas, and that the ideas of the Jews light up the world. So what we won was the philosophy of Hellenism over Judaism. Judaism wins, Jewish philosophy wins, Jewish wisdom wins, and the light miraculously lights up the world. So every time we light the candles, what we're saying is, the Jewish philosophy of the world is and will ultimately be victorious, is correct in its underpinnings, will be victorious, and will be the ultimate light that lights up the whole world. So, but the candles, that small miracle is symbolic of the whole larger miracle, because you can't tell if a war is miraculously won or not. You know, history can be rewritten, refelt. Anybody who was around during the Six-Day War, so they might have felt at the time that it was absolutely miraculous, which most Jews did at the time. Today, people wonder, was it, wasn't it? But in the moment, it really felt like it. And if you look in history, some people will still say it is, but we can wonder about it today. But if candles last for longer than is naturally acceptable for a certain amount of oil, that's a clear miracle. And so you can't wonder, was that divine or not? So that's why we put all the miracles of Hanukkah into that one little thing, even though that was a tiny miracle compared to everything else.
What was the time frame during this particular period? What were the dates?
This is the, so I wish I had the exact date of Hanukkah. Do I have that on here? it's the middle of the Second Temple period. And the Second Temple is about 200 years. So we have the beginning of the Second Temple period with, let's see, Alexander the Great dies in 323, but the temple was established probably around 3, it goes down, right? I always get mixed up, like, you know, with a little being dyslexic and the dates going. It starts before Alexander the Great, and then goes until it's destroyed in 70. So it's about a 400-year period, and right in the middle is when Hanukkah happens.
Now, was this during the time of the Great Assembly? And the?
So the Great Assembly is done already. We still have the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin remains untainted. But the men of the Great Assembly, which started out with the Sanhedrin, which is 70 sages, and was swelled to 120, as those additional 120, as the additional 50 died, then they just kept it at 70. And they replaced to keep it at 70, but not at 120. So the last one was Shimon HaTzadik, the Simon the Great, and he died. He's the one who met Alexander the Great. And when he died, that's when, let's see, is that's when we had this division where Chonio, the older brother, goes down to Alexandria and the younger brother continues with the high priesthood in Israel. But we have one more quick point that we need to make before next week, so I can leave you on your cliffhanger for this. So Now we have the final Maccabee, those five brothers. One lives, four die in the war. One lives, Simon, Shimon. He becomes the high priest. They are a Kohen family. He can become the high priest. Now the high priesthood has already been a little corrupted by Antiochus. Anyway, it's corrupted a little bit because we have problems with power and corruption and, you know, we're human beings. So it is a powerful position. Should it be totally powerful? Really, it should be a religious figurehead and also a king, so that they both rule and they have their own rule and they work together. But since there's no king, so the high priest position has a little more power than it should, which can lead to a little more problems, but especially with what Antiochus opened up of having a puppet high priest whose job it was to run everything and try to cajole people into certain places. So he had kind of corruption laid down, seeds of corruption laid down in that area. But meanwhile, Shimon, the last one of the Maccabees, was not corrupt. He took the position as high priest, and he ran it well, even though he didn't call himself king, but he did have the position of that. So he had both positions. He didn't give himself the name of king and high priest, but he had that power, which he allowed himself to have because he understood the difference between the two. However, those who came after him didn't, and didn't separate the names and didn't separate the power, and the high priesthood became very corrupt. Now, two people wanted to be high priest. One of them's name was Tzadok, and I'm not sure exactly where, but shortly thereafter, there's a battle between these two. Who's going to be the high priest next? Tzadok and somebody else. Somebody else gets to be high priest, and Tzadok is miffed and does what miffed Jews do, starts his own thing. So he starts his own thing, which mixes in Greek philosophy. His own thing is called Tzaduki, because his name is Tzadok. And in English or Greek, we call that Sadducee. So he starts the Sadducee philosophy. The Sadducee philosophy is that he starts a lot of trouble for the Jews, actually. The Jews, remember we said, so now there's no prophets, so we're moving into a period of rabbinic Judaism where the codes of law are starting to be written. The Judaism is held in the hands of rabbis who are trying to do the very best to make Judaism as correct as it can be, and there are those who resent that. Who says you get to say? So Tzadok's one of those, and he says, who says you get to say? I don't hold by any of your oral law. I go only by the written law. So whatever it says in the five books, that's what it is. No such thing as the oral law. Now, anybody who's looked at all, and I'm sure you've heard in other classes, you can't have written law without oral law. They have to go together because there's way too much explanation that's necessary in the oral law for the written law to be able to be understood. And yet he creates his own whole own philosophy. In that philosophy, to make it more Greek and more palatable to people and to make it work for him better, he does away with the concept of soul and afterlife and reward and punishment. So there still is God and responsibility to God, and he gives us the book of the Torah and he has the commandments in it, but you're not going to get punished and there's no ultimate life, there's no resurrection. So he really can have his whole own, whatever he wants. That works very well with the Greek philosophy and the Greek gods of first cause, set it and forget it type of a god. And people are in charge of the world, get to do what they want. And there is no such thing as sin in the Greek system. And so no possibility to transgress because you have the Greek gods looking like poorly behaved humans. So humans can't act worse than they do. So there is no striving to be godlike. The Jews strive to go up. The Greeks created gods and brought them down so that there's no sin in that system. So that worked out very nicely for the whole Sadduceic philosophy. And then we had the other group that had to pull away and now give themselves a name, the mainstream Jews, called the Pharisees, the Prushim, which really interestingly means separatists, but they weren't separatists, they were just separate from that. So now we're going to find out what happens in the battle next time between the Sadducees and the Pharisees and where that brings us. But I'll just leave you with the one just to finish this page, so we will get done with the whole page in one time, is the ironic name of the Maccabiah. So the Maccabiah is about as Greek an event as you can get. It's a sports event, right? And it's all about Greek philosophy and making physical strength the thing competing physically. And it's named after the Maccabees, who fought against Greek philosophy. So I just wanted to point out the ironic name that doesn't fit at all and why we call it that. It has to do with the concept of strength and that the Maccabees represent strength to us. But their strength was really strength of ideas, and then the marshaling of the physical to bolster the strength of the ideas, and not the paramount strength of body and the competition of strength of bodies. So as the Maccabiah comes here this summer, we could enjoy it, but just have in mind that it's ineptly named, and that's just the irony of the day. Thanks.